Closely connected with the vagueness of men's ideas about property was the vagueness of their ideas about currency. Both the American and the French republics fell into serious trouble upon this score. Here again, we deal with something that's not simple, a tangle of usages, conventions, laws, and prevalent mental habits, out of which arise problems which admit of no solution in simple terms, and which yet are of vital importance to the everyday life of the community. The validity of the acknowledgement of a man is given for a day's work is manifestly of quite primary importance to the working of the social machine. The growth of confidence in the precious metals and of coins, until the assurance became practically universal that good money could be trusted to have its purchasing power anywhere, must have been a gradual one in human history. And being fairly established, this assurance was subjected to very considerable strains and perplexities by the action of governments in debasing currency and in substituting paper promises to pay for the actual metallic coins. Every age produced a number of clever people, intelligent enough to realize the opportunities for smart operations afforded by the complex of faiths and fictions upon which the money system rested, and sufficiently unsound morally to give their best energies to growing rich and so getting people to work for them through tricks and tampering with gold, coinage, and credit. So soon as serious political and social dislocation occurred, the money mechanism began to work stiffly and inaccurately. The United States and the French Republic both started their careers in a phase of financial difficulty. Everywhere governments had been borrowing and issuing paper promises to pay interest, more interest than they could conveniently raise. Both revolutions led to much desperate public spending and borrowing, and at the same time to an interruption of cultivation and production that further diminished real taxable wealth. Both governments, being unable to pay their way in gold, resorted to the issue of paper money, promising to pay upon the security of undeveloped land in America or recently confiscated church lands in France. In both cases, the amount of issue went far beyond the confidence of men in the new security. Gold was called in, hidden by the cunning ones, or went abroad to pay for imports, and people found themselves with various sorts of bills and notes in the place of coins, all of uncertain and diminishing value. However complicated the origins of currency, its practical effect and the end it has to serve in the community may be stated roughly in simple terms. The money a man receives for his work, mental or bodily, or for relinquishing his property in some consumable good, must ultimately be able to purchase for him, for his use, a fairly equivalent amount of consumable goods. Consumable goods is a phrase we would have understood in the widest sense to represent even such things as a journey, a lecture or theatrical entertainment, housing, medical advice, and so forth. When everyone in a community is assured of this, and assured that the money will not deteriorate its purchasing power, then currency and the distribution of goods by trade is in a healthy and satisfactory state. Then men will work cheerfully, and only then. The imperative need for that steadfastness and security of currency is the fixed datum from which the scientific study and control of currency must begin. But under the most stable conditions, there'll always be fluctuations in currency value. The sum total of saleable consumable goods in the world and in various countries varies from year to year and from season to season. Autumn is probably a time of plenty in comparison with spring. With an increase in the available goods in the world, the purchasing power of currency will increase, unless there's also an increase in the amount of currency. On the other hand, if there's a diminution in the production of consumable goods, or a great and unprofitable destruction of consumable goods, such as occurs in a war, the share of the total of consumable goods, represented by a sum of money, will diminish, and prices and wages will rise. In modern war, the explosion of a single big shell, even if it hits nothing, destroys labor and material roughly equivalent to a comfortable cottage or a year's holiday for a man. If the shell hits anything, then that further destruction has to be added to the diminution of consumable goods. Every shell that burst in the recent war diminished by a little fraction the purchasing value of every coin in the whole world. If there's also an increase of currency during a period when consumable goods are being used up and not fully replaced, and the necessities of revolutionary and war-making governments almost always require this, then the enhancement of prices and the fall in the value of the currency paid in wages is still greater. Usually, also, governments under these stresses borrow money, that's to say, they issue interest-bearing paper, secured on the willingness and ability of the general community to endure taxation. Such operations would be difficult enough if they were carried out frankly by perfectly honest men in the full light of publicity and scientific knowledge. But hitherto, this has never been the case. At every point, the clever egotist, the bad sort of rich man, is trying to deflect things a little to his own advantage. Everywhere, too, one finds the stupid egotist ready to take fright and break into panic. Consequently, we presently discover the state encumbered by an excess of currency, which is in effect a non-interest-paying debt, and also with a great burthen of interest upon loans. Both credit and currency begin to fluctuate wildly with the evaporation of public confidence. They are, we say, demoralized. The ultimate consequence of an entirely demoralized currency would be to end all work and all trade that couldn't be carried on by payment in kind and barter. Men would refuse to work except for food, clothing, housing, and payment in kind. The immediate consequence of a partially demoralized currency is to drive up prices and make trading feverishly adventurous and workers suspicious and irritable. A sharp man wants under such conditions to hold money for as brief a period as possible. He demands the utmost for his reality, and buys a reality again as soon as possible in order to get this perishable stuff, the currency paper, off his hands. All who have fixed incomes and saved accumulations suffer by the rise in prices, and the wage earners find, with a gathering fury, that the real value of their wages is continually less. Here's a state of affairs where the duty of every clever person is evidently to help adjust and reassure, but all the traditions of private enterprise, all the ideas of the later 18th century, went to justify the action of acute-minded and dexterous people who set themselves to accumulate claims, titles, and tangible property in the storms and dislocations of this currency breakdown. The number of understanding people in the world who were setting themselves sincerely and simply to restore honest and workable currency and credit conditions were few and ineffectual. Most of the financial and speculative people of the time were playing the part of Cornish wreckers, not apparently with any conscious dishonesty, but with the completest self-approval and the applause of their fellow men. The aim of every clever person was to accumulate as much as he could of really negotiable wealth, and then, and only then, to bring about some sort of stabilizing political process that would leave him in advantageous possession of his accumulation. Here were the factors of a bad economic atmosphere: suspicious, feverish, greedy, and speculative. In the third direction in which the revolution had been unprepared, with clear ideas, the problem of international relationships, developments were to occur that interacted disastrously with this state of financial and economic adventure, this scramble and confusion, this preoccupation of men's minds with the perplexing slipperiness of their private property and their monetary position at home. The Republic at its birth found itself at war. For a time, that war was waged by the new levies with a patriotism and a zeal unparalleled in the world's history. But that couldn't go on. The Directory found itself at the head of a conquering country, intolerably needy and embarrassed at home, and in occupation of rich foreign lands, full of seizable wealth and material and financial opportunity. We have all double natures, and the French, in particular, seem to be developed logically and symmetrically on both sides. Into these conquered regions, France came as a liberator, a teacher of republicanism to mankind. Holland and Belgium became the Batavian Republic, Genoa and its Riviera the Ligurian Republic, North Italy the Cisalpine Republic, Switzerland was rechristened the Helvetian Republic, Mulhausen, Rome, and Naples were designated republics. Grouped about France, these republics were to be a constellation of freedom leading the world. That was the ideal side. At the same time, the French government and French private individuals in concert with the government proceeded to a complete and exhaustive exploitation of the resources of these liberated lands. So, within 10 years of the meeting of the States General, New France begins to take on a singular likeness to the old. It's more flushed, more vigorous. It wears a cap of liberty instead of a crown. It has a new army, but a damaged fleet. It has new rich people instead of the old rich people. A new peasantry, working even harder than the old and yielding more taxes. A new foreign policy, curiously like the old foreign policy, disrobed. And there is no millennium.